Good day, and welcome to the 2021 Leapfrog Hospital Survey Monitoring Healthcare Inequity Town Hall Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Missy Danforth. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, and welcome, everyone. I am so excited today for this presentation focused on monitoring healthcare inequity. Just a couple housekeeping items. This call is being recorded. We will make an abbreviated version of the slides and the recording itself available on our website, www.leapfroggroup.org, following this presentation. We will also be holding a live question and answer session following today's presentation, so please hold your questions to the end, and then our operator, Nick, will come back on the line and give everyone instructions so you can ask questions directly to any of our speakers today. Again, thank you so much for joining us, and I will turn it over to Leapfrog's President and CEO, Leah Binder.
Thank you, Missy. It's great to be with you all today. I appreciate your joining us. Last year, Leapfrog's Board of Directors adopted a long-term strategic goal for health equity among patients seeking care in hospitals and ambulatory surgery centers. So that has been the main focus of our annual survey efforts starting this year. Specifically, the board and Leapfrog's leadership aim to study and promote the best practices for delivery of healthcare services to address lags in quality and patient safety associated with healthcare inequities. We also want to educate Leapfrog's constituency of purchasers, unemployers, patient and family advocates, health plans, and you on how best to incentivize equitable healthcare delivery. And finally, we want to advocate for and publicly report on by facility payment strategies that reward achievement of excellent care for all patients with no inequities in the quality of care based on race, ethnicity, LGBTQ identification, disability, and other statuses. Although a complex range of factors influence inequities in health status, Leapfrog will focus on those associated with the delivery of healthcare services, such as poor outcomes or faulty diagnoses associated with bias. As a first step, Leapfrog added a new set of fact-finding questions to both the 2021 Leapfrog Hospital Survey and the ASC survey, focused on collecting patient-reported demographic information, ensuring the accuracy of the data collected, and using it to stratify process, outcome, or patient experience measures, such as HCAHPS measures. We are asking hospitals and ASCs whether they stratify their data now, and what they do, if they do stratify it, what they do with the information once they have it, on any disparities in the delivery of care that may exist. We're asking them to take those actions to reduce or eliminate the disparities. And because Leapfrog's focus has always been on organizational accountability and transparency, we're asking two additional questions about whether or not that information is shared with the board or the public. So as an additional step to meeting our long-term strategic goal, we've started to assemble a national advisory panel of hospitals and health system leaders who have demonstrated effectiveness in eliminating healthcare inequities and developing best practices. And so today, we're really pleased and so grateful to hear from four members of that panel whose work we are studying very closely. And so here from the Massachusetts General Hospital is Aswita Tan McGrory. She's Administrative Director of the Mongan Institute and the Disparities Solution Center at Mass General. And in her role, she leads the center's portfolio of projects focused on addressing racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare. Ms. Tan McGrory also travels across the country to speak to organizations about how race, ethnicity, and language impact the quality of care. Also from Mass General, we have Andrea Tull. She's Senior Director of Quality Performance Management at the hospital. She has 20 years' experience in performance management in the healthcare and social service industries. She currently serves in her role at the Quality Performance Management in the Lawrence Center for Quality and Safety at Mass General. Andrea leads a broad portfolio of quality and safety evaluation and operational activities, including regulatory quality reporting, clinical quality measurement, health equity measurement, and safety reporting. She currently co-leads an initiative on eliminating disparities in clinical care with colleagues from the Disparities Solution Center. We also have with us Christopher Nolan. He's System Manager for Community Health and Benefit, Office of Community Health Equity and Engagement at Rush University System for Health. In his role, Christopher is responsible for Rush's Community Health Needs Assessment, Community Health Implementation Plan, Community Benefits Report, and oversight of an interprofessional project management and community health worker team. Under Christopher's leadership, Rush University Medical Center has maintained a perfect score on the Human Rights Campaign Foundation's Healthcare Equity Index since 2009. And in 2019, all three Rush hospitals were certified as leaders with perfect scores. That is extraordinary. And finally, we have Mayka Neblett. She is Chief Medical Officer for RWJ Barnabas Health Community Medical Center. Board certified in emergency medicine, Dr. Neblett has extensive experience as a leader overseeing medical staff. She is the Robert Wood Johnson Barnabas Health Lead for Equity in Clinical Care, a subcommittee of Robert Wood Johnson Barnabas Health Ending Racism Culture Transformation, something we all want to hear much more about. So with that, I am going to open it up to our first presenter. I believe it's Aswita Tanmaguri. Aswita?
Hi, welcome everyone, and I will be co-presenting with Andrea Tull, and I just want to highlight to everybody in the audience that this is kind of in a perfect world. This is how you want to have your setup, somebody from the quality space who really knows everything about measurement and quality, and then somebody in the role of sort of advising around disparities and can talk in that context of like, okay, what do we see in the data and what do we see in our literature and in the real world. So I'm going to do the first half and then turn it over to Andrea. So if we can move to the next slide. I really wanted to start off because it's, we're starting off and who doesn't like pictures of kids? But I wanted to give you a case study of like why it's a, of that sort of talks about the importance of data collection. So I was doing a lot of work at Mass General Hospital and was doing a lot around implementing race ethnicity data collection. And this is a picture of my oldest daughter who is now 15. So this is when I first started adding this picture to my slide deck. I think she's 7 here. And the reason I took this picture is because my daughter at that time when I was doing a lot of work at Mass General Hospital turned to me one day and said, oh, mommy, she's like, I'm Irish. So I'm married to my husband is born and raised in Ireland, and I was born and raised in the Netherlands, and I'm Dutch, Indonesian, and German. So it's a very mixed family. And when she said that to me, I was like, well, you know, there's actually, it's not just Irish, there's also Indonesian. And, you know, and then she said with very firm, you know, sort of knowledge that a 7-year-old has, and she said, no, mommy, I'm Irish. And I remember thinking, okay, this is interesting in my personal life. Like if we did her race ethnicity data, who's right? Am I right or is she right, right? The importance of self-collected, self-reported data. And I sort of thought about, like, why is it that she thinks that she is Irish when I know that that's not the full story? So if you don't mind moving to the next slide, you see a picture here of my daughter in Ireland with her cousins, and I think you can tell which one is my daughter. But these are all of her cousins, and I realized that she really loves being in Ireland. And she, when she goes there, my sister-in-law has a farm with animals and cows and sheep and all sorts of stuff. She gets to run around. It's just a very happy place compared to living in the city in Boston where, like, the biggest thing we see is a rat in our backyard. So you can understand that even living in Boston, Ireland, being Irish is a big deal. So St. Patrick's Day is a big deal in Ireland, and we always celebrate it with our Irish friends and family. And so it made sense to me why to a 7-year-old she would have more affinity for the Irish side of her. I will just tell you that that has changed since she's gotten older. And she really, while she loves the Irish side and she recognizes that, she really has an affinity now for the Indonesian side, and it sort of translates into learning more about the culture, wanting to learn a language, and also cooking. So these things change over time, which also highlights the importance of continually asking people to confirm that this is the correct information that we have in our record. And then next slide, please. This is my youngest. She is 9, but at this time I think she was 3 maybe. She has not told me how she self-identifies, not for race anyway. And so my point is that even though my two daughters are in the same family with the same parents, they might have extreme differences about how they self-identify. And so that's important that we don't make assumptions. And I would just say the other thing is that I know that in Boston there's a huge Irish contingency. And so somebody might say to my daughters, you're not Irish, I'm Irish. I'm Irish because my great-grandmother is from Kerry. So, you know, there is going to be a time when people contest how they self-identify. And so I think we always get into this conundrum, like, should we really be doing self-reporting when this is about potential racial bias, because the bias is not on the person but is done by somebody to them. And I would just say, like, I think what we can rely on the best is how patients self-identify. That is the gold standard. Next slide. And so then if you look at what has traditionally been sort of the gold standard for race ethnicity categories, this is the Office of Management and Budget, or OMB. You'll often hear that term. My daughters don't neatly fit into this if they're only asked to select one category. But it is the best that we have, and it's better than nothing, which we also have. And you might have seen that in the COVID data. A lot of the state COVID data is not parsed out by race and ethnicity because it's not available. So, yes, this is not perfect, but it's better than zero, which is what we have in a lot of instances. And I will just say, I do recognize that this is so outdated, right? And racial constructs is like a hot button. And it's really making this assumption that, like, people of the same race marry each other, which is definitely not the case in my family, right? It just sort of assumes that you would only identify with one because, you know, your parents might be of the same race. So it's outdated for sure, but, you know, we need to start somewhere because no data is, like, absolutely not acceptable. So the next slide, please. I will just say that, like, this is not new. There's a growing multiracial population. You'll see it more in the pediatric population before you see it in an adult population. This is the future, so we need to kind of get going on this. And next slide, please. And it's in part due to the increase in interracial marriages. The second thing I would say, so that's the importance of self-reported data. The second thing I will say is you need to review sort of where your race and ethnicity language data comes from. So I just want to show you the next slide, please. I know this is like a total eye chart, but what this is that this is a process map that I put together in the very beginning a couple years ago, and this is my recommendation to you. I think we make a lot of assumptions about where our data comes from, and then I actually try to figure out what are all the different entry points to race ethnicity data in our system. And this is really complicated, and I'll try to sort of walk you through it in like 1 second. But what you see here is that it is complicated, right? We are multi-site location. Mass General Brigham is the sort of umbrella organization for many different hospitals. And at some point, now we're all on Epic, but at some point we were all using different methodology for collecting this data. We also have collaborations with other institutions, so you have to try and figure out, like, if that data is coming into our system, if our data is different from theirs, like, which data is considered correct. And then you also have, like, other access points like the emergency room, the patient call center. We actually didn't realize that 80% of our registration happens over the phone. So a lot of our training initially we did for the in-person admitting staff, and sort of like not realizing that most of the registration happens over the phone. And so we've since sort of like focused on them. But it's just something you probably wouldn't realize until you do this process map. There's also admitting services on the inpatients on the floor, which is also, again, separate. There's affiliated community health centers, which was separate for us. And then the favorite is Patient Gateway, which is our patient portal. You know, this has been seen as like a way to get this information from patients, but as you probably can guess, that's only if you're like me and carry an iPhone and are pretty savvy and speak good English. This would be more challenging for folks that are older, folks that are not health literate, they're not tech savvy, they don't have the technology to do it. So, you know, patient portals, while in an ideal world, would be a great way for us to get this. It's not really feasible for everyone. We are leaving people behind if we only rely on this. Next slide. And so these are, you know, we'll share these slides, but like these are all the questions that came in. Like once I did a process map, so that's why I would recommend that you do it. It's like questions like, hey, if a baby is born in our hospitals, how do we determine the race? It turns out that the default is the race of the mother. Now you can imagine how that can be problematic, but often actually it's just left blank. And so this is something that we needed to address, like who oversees the training in the ED if we're not touching that through our portals or our ways of training, and who can change the information? Is this a primary care physician? If they're in the office and they notice that something's different, can they change it? Can the front desk change this information? And if the patient updates their record in Patient Gateway, does that automatically populate to all of the system? So these are sort of, you know, as I always say, the devil's in the detail. And so then I'm going to turn it over. Oh, wait. Andrew, you have to help me. Are you doing the next slide?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So I'm turning it over to you.
Thank you. So to just continue along the same lines, one of the early learnings for us was the complexity of the emergency department in particular, and the challenges there with data collection. And if you go to the next slide, you can imagine patients coming into the ED, they may not be already seen in your system and in your data set. They may not be conscious. They may not have someone with them who can answer the question. So this makes it really challenging. And I'll tell you, last spring during our COVID surge, we really saw this happening, and we saw an increase in the degree of missing data for race, ethnicity, and language, because we just had this steady stream of patients coming through the ED in severe respiratory distress. They're getting intubated. They can't have visitors because of COVID restrictions, on and on. So that just created led to a lot of missing data, and then created a need to do some follow-up more downstream in the inpatient stay to try to circle back and collect that data. But I think it's challenging when folks are just starting on this journey to consider all of the various inputs, because it is complicated and each one has its own set of specific issues that you need to address. And typically when we think about launching a new training program, we think of the registrars, the front desk staff, but not necessarily these other folks who are really critical to collecting the data. Next slide. And then speaking of training, I think, you know, a lot of folks starting out on this work put together a training for their staff, and it's like, great, we did that, check the box, we're all set. But the real story is you're just never done with this. It just it's really an annual process. There's a lot of turnover with these positions, and you're constantly bringing folks up to speed. And if you go to the next slide, one of the things that we've learned through the years is really giving those front desk staff the tools and tips that they need to have these conversations with people. So this is an example of a script that was provided during the training. You can see it helps the staff answer some of the challenging questions that might come from patients. You know, why do you need this data? Who gets to see it? Where is it being stored? How are you going to use it? I'm human, race isn't important. We hear these things a lot. So it gives them a little bit of a script to follow and some tips on having those conversations. And obviously in the training, this is something that is worked with through role play, et cetera, so folks get comfortable with it. Next slide, please. And then finally, as Aswita mentioned earlier with regard to the OMB classifications not being perfect, the language around all of these categories constantly evolving, right? Our consciousness in terms of the public constantly evolving. People are going out and doing Ancestry.com and 23andMe and getting new awareness of, you know, their own background, and that might change how they self-identify. And so it's not necessarily, we tend to think of race as an ascribed characteristic. It's kind of the old way of thinking about it. Oh, it doesn't change. But it can change, and it does change in the data. So you need to be aware of that and think about how to handle that when it comes to the analytical phase. And then finally, you know, race, ethnicity, and data are the first building blocks, and it's where we often start. But there are so many other demographic characteristics that are really important to consider. So we're currently working on collecting disability identity, sexual orientation, gender identity, et cetera. We do a good job with AIDS. We do a good job with payer. But some of these other things we really need to work on and ramp up. So that's where we're headed with this work. Next slide. So when these slides are shared, you'll be able to click in here and go to the website for the Disparity Solutions Center. And here you'll be able to link to our annual report that we produce where we stratify a lot of our measures and then publicly report on the disparities that we find and also what we're doing about them. And then there's also links in here to the program that Aswita leads, the Disparities Leadership Program. So we'll just I'll do a shameless self-promotion here for Aswita, that this is a terrific program for anyone interested in learning more about this work. Next slide. Thank you so much. We're happy to take questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrea, and thank you, Aswita. That was extraordinary. And Aswita, I loved seeing the photos of your children. It really does remind us how much is at stake for all of us in doing this work. So thank you. Our next speaker is Christopher Nolan from Rush University Medical Center.
Thank you very much, Leah. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes, perfectly.
Great. Perfect. Thanks. I'm just using my headphones. As I told my fellow panelists, my air conditioner is roaring next to me, so the challenges of working from home, and also privileges. That being said, I am very grateful to be here, and thank you, LeapFrog, for including Rush and myself in this work. We are very proud to be on this journey for improving and enhancing our work around race, ethnicity, and language, and sexual orientation and gender identity data for our patients and community members. My name is Christopher Nolan. As mentioned, my pronouns are he, him, and I'm the system manager for Community Health and Benefit, and I have been one of the kind of main people at Rush working on some of these enhancements with partners throughout the health system, and we'll tell you a little bit about that. Next slide. So just to give you a background for who Rush is, I think it's important just to kind of set the stage for where we are in our equity journey, because I think that this very much aligns with it. Rush is an academic health system spanning the greater Chicagoland, and our mission is to improve the health of individuals and diverse communities we serve through the integration of patient care, education, research, and community partnerships. I think the important here is noting individuals and diverse communities we serve. When we think about this, we need to recognize some of these disparities, and that really is aligned with our work. We do have a health equity office, of which I sit in. We have a senior VP for community health equity, Dr. David Antle. So this role is definitely rolling into an equity framework, but also starting to pair it, and I'll talk about today, with different offices, as Aswita mentioned, right, about connecting these different areas, but making sure that quality is involved, making sure that you've got your main drivers within patient care to start connecting to this work. I think what's really important is also recognizing that a lot of this work that we're doing right now, some of it is required, some of it is standardized, but we're also starting to see movement, right? We heard from our MassGen colleagues about seeing more multiracial individuals. We're starting to also recognize that sexual orientation and gender identity are also going to be fluid and not necessarily going to be set when you first ask someone. So we're starting to see a lot of impact and movement, and excited to tell you about it. Next. So just to give you a sense for who we are, we have three hospitals within the health system, our flagship being Rush University Medical Center on the west side of Chicago, and then also Rush Copley Medical Center and Rush Oak Park Hospital, which are both community hospitals. Aurora is the second biggest city in the state, which is where Rush Copley is based, and then Oak Park is just outside of the city limits in the neighboring west side suburbs. And then obviously Rush University, which is our health sciences university that has over 2,500 students, and we have direct integration between our health system and the university, including our medical college, College of Nursing, Graduate College, and College of Health Sciences. Next. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about our Real and Soji journey and just kind of where we've been and how we've laid this out for senior leaders. So I'm actually going to have, if you don't mind, I'm going to have you go to the next slide. I'm going to come back to this one just because of the way I'm going to talk through this. So I want to tell you kind of how we first brought this to our senior leaders, because I think that what's really important in just talking to Missy and Leah and folks with LeapFrog is thinking about how to get your leadership engaged in this work. And something that we've done is really working on what is the background and reason for action about how this even came up, right? Like, I'm in community health equity. Obviously, I'm going to be very much for improving our work around Real and Soji. Most people will when you start thinking about demonstrating how it impacts care. So part of it was making sure that we're telling our journey and story in ways that everyone from their own respective areas will understand it. So in 2018, which I will share this link to our health equity report, we recognize, so our health equity report within our organization is looking particularly at our patients and those that come through the Rush system. And what we recognized back in 18 when this was published was that there was some questioning around the validity of data that we had. And this is really where this journey started to stem, was this doesn't look right. We know that we have more Spanish-speaking patients. How is this not connecting between Hispanic and how is this not connecting between Spanish-speaking when you're asking about language? It just didn't feel right. And this is going all the way up to our system CEO saying, you know what, we need to look into this. And we wouldn't have had that information if we didn't do a health equity report on our patients. So I think that's a really important first step, is looking at who you have in your system, looking at does this sound right? Because even though we might have the standardized process for collecting real data for race, ethnicity, and language, there are a lot of factors that go into that, right? And I think that as we and Andrea were saying that, right, is it's training, it's how are you asking it, does it change, do you standardize, can you get it at multiple different points throughout the system, right? We recognize that we had 26 different entry points where this might be coming in. So we also recognize that we participated in Vizient's Equity Organizational Survey in 2018 as well, and one of the areas that was called out, which, you know, we have to be real on this, right, we're going to do these things honestly because we want to improve. So recommend anyone who's not participating in these areas, definitely that would be a great first step because you got to recognize your starting point, was gaps in data collection, data validation, communicating findings. This was starting to mirror what we saw with our equity report. So as you can recognize, we see a little bit of a trend. So this has actually led to saying we might need to work on this. We were very honored and gracious to be featured with the American Hospital Association's Equity of Care Award. We're an honorary 4 years running up until COVID times. But we were yet to actually get the full honor, which this shouldn't be a driver, but what's important is that they actually give you feedback when you apply, which for us is really great. We're very grateful for that feedback as well, because what's the area that's being called out? Race, ethnicity, and language, sexual orientation, and gender identity. Again, you're seeing these trends. So, like, all right, we have to do something about this. This is clearly impacting our quality. It could impact our quality, right? They're Vizient's recognizing this. We're seeing it with our own data. AHA is recognizing this. So let's make some changes on this. And what's really great is that when you participate in these areas, you now have this kind of backbone to say why we need to do this. And our senior leaders very much bought into this thing. All right, we have to make some work on this. So we actually have a Rush Health Equity Governance Group, and we made this a priority for FY20. You'll notice some changes with the time frame here. COVID definitely has made this a bit of a challenge, so we're kind of re-embarking on the journey now. But it was a priority for FY20, and we started to lay down the foundation originally with REAL because we knew that we'd already been asking that information. We also made this a quality improvement goal for FY20. What was really important about this is that we were leaning into our quality work and making sure that this actually became part of it rather than a standalone. So you can actually see our goal there, develop standard workflows and scripting for collecting and documenting race, ethnicity, and language data accurately. We also added SOGI because we felt that if we're going to do this, let's do it. If you wouldn't mind going back a slide. So then what we did was that in regards to this journey is that we kind of, I'm laying out your framework. I'm not going to go through everything, but I want to lay out the framework about how we did this because I think that it's very replicable and hopefully folks can take from this. So the first and foremost is that we called out a problem statement, which I will get to shortly, and then really leaning into having that background information that I just laid out to you because you have to have the leadership buy-in. That was something that was critical for us about getting our senior leaders involved. They might have had to recognize that this is an area of improvement from their own data, but you need to start giving the reasons for why it's important and how do you make sure that you have the resources allocated to this. For example, my colleague Nosheen, being from quality, how do you make sure that she gets put on this project to make this happen? Best practices, we looked at Vizient. We looked at Human Rights Campaign. We've been very proud to lead our healthcare equality index work with Human Rights Campaign. Rush was the first hospital in the state to get a perfect score back in 2009. We eventually got Rush Oak Park and Rush Copley certified as well. This is something that's called out in the Healthcare Equality Index. We're doing it. We've definitely been on the forefront with making sure that we collect sex orientation and gender identity data, but we definitely have seen room for improvement because we do it more with clinical focus rather than at registration. Developing workflows. Making sure that we're going through the process and what this looks like, those downstreams that were mentioned by our MassGen colleagues. Training and development, again, always needing to train, building this into turnover and building it into our EPIC training. Quality assurance to make sure that it's working. You got to double check. It's not going to be, this isn't just one and done. And then continuity and sustainability. Could you go ahead 2 slides, please? So our problem statement that we put forward to our leadership was looking at recognizing that we need to lean into both REAL and SOGI. And the main reasons why we did this was looking at the fact that we have inconsistent standards, lack of standard training and scripting, and what this is leading to is that questionable data, which inhibits us from monitoring health outcomes. So that's what's so critical about the why are we doing it, right? Is it some people might be like, why are you asking this? Why is this really important? But we're not going to be able to tackle these inequities if we don't have the right information from the start. So starting to look at the health outcomes from a health equity lens. And then also we recognize that not getting proper gender identity data, you might have someone misgendered routinely throughout their care. Absolutely not what we want to be doing. We need to make sure that those standards are in play. And then lastly, standardizing and improving the process is critical to our work. Go ahead. Kind of laid out why I'm not going to go fully into the kind of why we need to go into SOGI data collection, but what was really important here was again laying out the stakes for the so what. This is not going to always be and can't be just in this equity world. You need to see your clinical folks leaning into this. You need to see your quality folks leaning into this. You need to try to cross cut the organization in regards to this information and start showing why. Showing that if you, like, why would you collect sexual orientation from registration, right? Someone's like, why on earth do I need to out myself from the beginning? Well, you start recognizing that you can't actually stratify that data without that information. You also start recognizing that certain services aren't going to be able to be provided accurately if you don't have that information. We know that there are disparities in the LGBTQ+ community, and we don't want that to be the case. And that's the thing, is that you need to think about how do you then train your teams on this, because they're going to be the ones that are asked this question, not me, right? Not my boss, not my department. It's going to be your front line being asked these questions. Like, why do you need that? So it's almost like you have to do an equity 101 with your teams about why are we doing this? And we hadn't done that before. Next. So some of the strategic project goals that I'll end with today is really thinking about how to, and we're leaning into Soju right now. We actually did launch Real. We've had some very good success. We've integrated some standardized training. But this is where we are now, and what we hope to keep sharing with you all going forward is that we are very much launching right now sexual orientation and gender identity at registration, which is very complicated. There are so many downstream effects to this because of insurance, clinical care, legal versus preferred name, what information you're using for someone's sex in regards to medical records and downstream. So there's a lot of factors that come with this. But we do want to integrate it into the workflows, the ethic templates. We'll be asking these questions and actually using a confidence level survey. So we want to make sure that our teams feel equipped to do this. The last thing you want to do is roll something out and have people not be ready for it. This is a starting point where some people are like, what is gender? What are pronouns? Right? That's sometimes some people's starting point. And we need to ask these questions and make sure that people feel equipped. We'll be trying to collect this with 100% of new patients at point of registration and then actually training 100% of our new staff, integrating this into the training processes for those that are a part of the Rush Access Center, which is also a new concept where all access points at Rush will be in one place. So I could keep going, but I'm going to transition over to Leah to bring it to Mika.
Thank you, Christopher. That was amazing. That's really inspiring what you're doing, and I will be watching closely as you go forward. Mika Neblett, Dr. Neblett, we're excited to hear from you now from Robert Wood Johnson, Barnabas Health in New Jersey.
Wonderful. So thank you very much for having me here today. Thanks to LeapFrog, the fellow panelists, for this interesting discussion and this journey that we're all on. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about equity and equality versus equality, and a term or phrase that Missy introduced me to, basically, when does a difference become a disparity and how that all works and the process that one journey we've been on since January, and we made some changes. This is very exciting. It's about pulse oximeter debate and how it's helping some people but not all. So just to set the stage with all this, equality means each individual or group of people are given the same resources and opportunities, and that sounds wonderful, but equity is understanding and recognizing that each person has a different circumstance that allows that circumstances and allocates the exact resources and opportunities needed to get the same outcome, but each person might need something different to get there. When does a difference become a disparity? When does it cross the line? And when do you elevate and escalate what's needed next? So to explain where we've been through, Robert Wood Johnson is on a journey towards ending racism. And there's four main goals to that. One of the goals is on equity in clinical care, and I'm in charge of that goal. So what's been happening is we've looked at the NJ, because we're in New Jersey, the NJ 2030 goals and looking at how we can ensure that we meet our NJ 2030 goals in each of the different areas, whether it's maternal health, diabetes, hypertension. And if anything comes up, we kind of look specifically at that, see where we are in the spectrum in disparities. So when you're looking at this, a simple process to do is you identify a problem. It can come in through an external source, and 60 Minutes, I'm addicted to 60 Minutes every Sunday night, and they've done a lot of really good pieces lately about bias and about disparities. You can find a journal article. Something might come in internally from an RCA or a patient complaint or an M&M that makes you realize that there's a problem that you have to go into further. You do the data and the research, and then most importantly is that you're transparent about it. You share the information. You share everything you've been looking at. Make sure you're open to all of your leadership. Make sure that you have CEO support. Make a plan and then follow up to see if your plan's been carried out. Thanks. So what happened is that we had our very first Equity in Clinical Care Task Force meeting, and I pulled some different articles to take a look. And one of the articles was this one, which was printed in 2005, and about effects of skin pigmentation on pulse oximeter accuracy at low saturation. In 2005, it was reported that dark skin pigmentation results in overestimation of pulse of arterial oxygen saturation. This is not the same for lighter skin and white people. You can keep going. There was a similar article we found back in 2007 that was the exact same group of people did the same research to see where it was, and in 2005 they found it, and then again in 2007 they found the exact same thing, which is showing that when monitoring saturations with darkly skinned people, there is a major bias. So if a saturation is in the 90s, on their finger, they might actually be in the 80s. And the racial errors, the disparity grows when you get in the low 90s. You can keep going. There's another article which was published in 2020, How a Popular Medical Device Encodes Racial Bias. The Pulse has stated that pulse oximeters give biased results for people with darker skin, and the consequences obviously could be serious. There are other examples of similar technology bias with photographic film, Fitbits, and facial recognition. You can keep going. This article from Boston Review says that unequal standards that have become normalized in science and medicine. There is a perception that bias is not a big deal, but it does matter. While the pulse ox is a key tool for some patients to decide when or when not to go to the hospital, it's also used directly at each hospital. And some physicians disagree on the clinical significance of the disparities. Some physicians were actually saying, does this really matter? We keep going. But obviously, any decision rooted within implicit bias will be detrimental to health. And many devices are just shaped by discriminatory design. Those who actually created the product did not even realize that there were inequalities because they didn't even think about others, people that are different than themselves. Right? What's very interesting is that there is a documentary called Coded Bias, and I have no stake in this documentary. It's a documentary on Netflix, and it's very interesting. It investigates the bias algorithms. This woman here that you can see, she did a facial recognition software review, and it did not recognize her dark skin at all. And then when she put on a white mask, it completely recognized the features, the nose, the mouth, the eyes. And this is very similar to what I'm saying, was there is a bias in a lot of equipment and products that are put out there, which affects us in the healthcare industry. Next. Another article came out in 2013 from the FDA. It stated the FDA encourages developers of pulse oximeters to test their devices on participant groups that include a range of skin tone. But this is the part that I found very interesting, is that your study should have subjects the range of skin pigmentations, including at least two darkly pigmented subjects, or 15% of your subject pool, whichever is larger. And I think this does not even close to represent what our patient population looks like. You can keep going. Another article in 2020 found the exact same thing. You can keep going. So what happened in January 25th of 2021, there was a letter from the Senate to the FDA demanding that the FDA conduct a review of the accuracy of pulse oximeters across racially diverse patients and consumers, knowing that they are stating that they may be misleading measures of pulse oximeters to patients of color, saying that this is increasingly affecting the risk of negative health impacts, and this all came out, obviously, with the pandemic and COVID-19. Keep going. So in February 2021, there was another article that came out in Stat Magazine, just a publication, stating that Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, and Ron Wyden urged the FDA to review the pulse oximeters. Okay. So what did we do? We identified the problem. This came from a journal article that we read and said we need to look at it further. We did the data and research, and as you see, at minimum, there were articles back from 2005, 2003, and we started doing some, I started doing some transparency, speaking about it at every CMO meeting, every CEO meeting, saying, this is what's going on. We put together a group to look at the problem, which included the product analysis team, which included respiratory therapists and head pulmonologists to take a look. Next. So I put together an SBAR and sent this out to everyone. And what we found was that most people had never heard of this, didn't know anything about it at all. You can keep going. When we put everybody together and had the subject matter experts together, what we found was that there were a lot of over-the-counter use pulse oximeters being used throughout our system. There were a lot of pulse oximeters that were not FDA approved. These are ones that were given out widely, not just at Barnabas, but at many other hospitals and doctors' offices. They were scrounging for any pulse ox. It was what you gave patients to go home with to monitor how well they were doing at home. But these pulse oxes, if you look them up, they're not FDA approved. They are approved for sports use and for high altitude and analyzation or analysis. We found that there were pulse oxes, we found that there were pulse oxes in use, not only in the doctor's office and ones that we were giving out in the ER, but also available on for purchase on one of our approved purchase sites. So what we have done with complete transparency is that we've removed any non-FDA approved pulse oximeters. We've removed them from availability for purchase on what we call our PeopleSoft. We've sent out this to all providers throughout, because the providers need to know the use and the proper limitation, or the proper use and limitations of this product, and they need to be able to communicate that with patients. You can go to the next. So what do you do now? So again, this is pretty simple. You find some data, you find out something that you want to look at. You go research it, do the data, look around, be transparent, start talking about it, mentioning it, and then you make sure that you have support from the leadership, and then you take an action, you make a plan, make an action, and then go back and follow it up. So most importantly is you need to be honest. This was not easy to be able to say that, hey, we realize we're not the only health system who, or the only doctors who have been giving out pulse oxes that are not FDA approved, and you need to be honest about it, or else you can't move forward, because this difference obviously created a disparity. One other thing that we found out, which I didn't even realize, is that some people carry pulse oxes in their pocket. So like physical therapists might put a little pulse ox on a patient before they do therapy on them. And so we've now eliminated that is not something they can do, because these are ones that they've bought at the store. And I think being open and honest and transparent is the hardest part about all of this work, but it's the only way that we're going to be able to properly move forward. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Neblett. That's really, that's eye-opening. I think everyone listening to this call, that's a step you can take right now in your hospital, in your system, is to look at your pulse ox distribution. Are you using FDA approved? And also, we all should be pressuring for an improvement in the equity of the device. I mean, that's just shocking. So thank you. Thank you all. And I think we're going to open now to questions from our,
yes.
Our operator is able to do that.
Thank you.
Yep, Nick, could you online? Thank you.
If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we'll pause for a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. And we do have our first question in queue. Caller, please go ahead. Caller, your line is now live. Perhaps you're muted on your end.
Hi, this is Bettina Riveras with Christiana Care. First, I want to give a shout-out to ASWEDA and the Disparities Leadership Program. Terrific program, really launched us into our work in health equity, so can't say enough great things about it. Terrific present town hall today, so thank you so much for the great speakers. I guess a quick question for Christopher, as you think about the SOGI, and we've had a SOGI work group for some time. We've done a lot of work on REL, and can you talk a little bit more specifically about that process? It sounds like you are using all your frontline registers to capture that data. Can you speak to that a little bit in more detail? That would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you so much for your question. So we are underway where we are about to, we have three hospitals, and we also learned during this process with REAL and SOGI that we had 26 different access points of when this data could be collected based on not having kind of a uniform process for becoming a patient at Rush. So it's also not always re-asked. It's kind of more of a, you're becoming a new patient, you're asked this information, it becomes this kind of set. In that, what we recognize is there are issues with that as well. But what we are doing now, what we're aiming to lean into, is actually having a standardized approach for anyone coming into the Rush system where sexual orientation and gender identity are going to be asked at the beginning. And this is definitely a change for us. We're going to lean into Epic does have this, but we're an Epic hospital and health system. So what we are going to do is lean into that process for basically turning on those modules with the training, but we will be collecting that. I can share more specifically how we are asking things at the beginning. I didn't include that in the slide deck, but we've worked through our own way of doing it. It's not that we aren't already doing it, right? So we have that currently where we have preferred names on the wristbands for procedures and whatnot, and then in small, like you might have that legal name that you need to make sure that you consult for a procedure and whatnot. But that's the goal, is that we'd be doing it at that one-stop shop kind of mentality where we get it all right at the beginning.
Great. That was helpful. Thank you. And does that also include, at what point are you capturing, like, for example, like organs, retention, like that, is that part of what you're doing at the outset, or are you doing that later on?
That will be more clinical. So we did differentiate that because I know that we can do that with it as well, and that's best practice for HRC as well for doing an organ inventory. We are leaving certain things to be clinical, but at the very least getting the basics around sexual orientation and gender identity from the beginning, and then we'll have a cascade effect for clinical documentation when they're actually in an office visit.
Great. Thank you so much.
And I'd be more than happy. So Matt Vail, who's our manager of Social Work and Navigation Services with our Center for Gender, Sexuality, and Reproductive Health, Affirm at Rush, he's going to be the lead on that. So I'd be more than happy to connect you if that would be helpful. I think we're always looking to also learn from others because it sounds like you've made some good movement as well.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Jackie Ortiz leads our work here. But, yeah, that would be terrific. Thanks.
Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we're glad to share that as well with the LeapFrog family, so to speak.
Thanks.
Do we have another question?
Thank you. As a reminder to our audience, you may ask a question by pressing *1 now.
There's a question that came through the chat. Leah, I don't know if you want to.
I'm going to read it now. Thank you. So the question is, what are your feelings on documentation of various elements of assessment where the response is normal for ethnicity? Thinking of Ms. Tam McGorry's antidote regarding her daughter's selection might not align with our personal conceptions of race and ethnicity. Based on your perception, based on observation of the patient, how safe is saying normal for ethnicity if our perceptions differ from the patient's self-identification? ASWEDA, can you take that one first?
Sure. I'm not sure what you mean by normal for ethnicity. I would probably just say that, again, the gold standard. Well, one thing that Andrew mentioned is all the genetics tests have shown us that, like, what we think might not be actually what is happening, right? And so it is hard for us to really know, like, if we want to get very scientific, like, what is actually people's genetic makeup in that sense. And so, you know, this isn't a perfect science, and I would just say that gold standard should be you ask the patient how do they self-identify, and you record their answer. Whether it, you know, falls within your categories or not, you always have other. We have a space where we have other, and people can write it in. It is not up to me to decide how you self-identify, and I would say, so who was correct in that example I gave of my daughter? The answer is my daughter, right? That's who she self-identifies with, and there's many instances where we have mixed racial families where somebody's adopted into a different culture, and they identify with that culture that they were raised with, even though they might not look like they're from that culture. So I would just say, like, the best person to answer that question is the patient, and that's what I would go with. And it won't fit neatly into all the buckets that you want, but that's okay. You know, we generally look at data in the aggregate anyway, so it'll all Andrea will fix it all in the tail end of it.
Thank you, Aswita. We have another really important question. I'll put this to all four panelists. What recommendations do you have for health systems in rural settings where there is a bias towards or a false perception of homogeneity? And Leah and I both actually came from a rural health system in Maine. I think this is an important question. Is there anyone that would like
I'm happy to answer, but I know our co-panelists will probably have thoughts about this as well. I would just say, like, things are fluid. Things are changing constantly. Populations change constantly. Immigration patterns change constantly. People marry outside of what traditionally has been happening. So even though maybe in the past rural areas might have been, so a lot of, like, what we think our biases that we have is colored by our historical past. And so we may think of Maine as being very non-diverse, but, like, there's pockets there that change. And the other thing I will just say is there's other ways that we can look at this, like lived experience and socioeconomic status as well. And so I would never make any assumptions. And until you collect the data from your patients and you know that the data is reliable, you honestly don't know necessarily who you're serving. You may be making assumptions about who you're serving, but you don't know for sure. And then the other question is, the caveat is, maybe you're serving this catchment area, but you're only getting a certain group from that catchment area. You're not serving the whole catchment area. And the question is, if your patients don't reflect your catchment area, then why? Right? So I think we definitely struggle with that at Mass General, like, not necessarily seen as a hospital welcoming for certain communities. And we have to ask ourselves the hard questions, why not? And then what can we do to change that?
So this is one other. Oh, go ahead, Leah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to add one thing to that is, if there's a bias or false perception about those that you're serving or the area that you're in, I would also recommend starting with your employees. So I think if there's some level of who's in your health system, you likely have a diverse group. I mean, you might not, right? But you do in other ways, right? So starting to think about demonstrating the diversity of those that you work with and who they are and letting people self-identify, I think that might be a way of, like, bringing people together around this or sharing stories. You know, like I don't think you necessarily want to tokenize them or they have to be this voice. But in some regard, is it when you hear someone's personal experience and maybe didn't go well, I think that also maybe lights a fire for some people in some ways. It makes them think about this differently, that, like, oh, that wasn't my experience, but that was my coworker's. And it changes mindset sometimes.
Unfortunately, I think I'll check in with Missy and Leah, but I think that we are running out of time, which is terrible because there's so many other questions I think we all have. And I would add one thing to the rural issue. Being from a rural community can be itself a disparity. The outcomes and the health status for people in rural areas had traditionally been challenged. And there are real reasons for that I think all health systems should address, including health systems in urban areas where they may be seeing folks from out of their community. So, but unfortunately we are out. I want to thank all of our panelists. This has been just extraordinary, and thank you for participating today and for all of the work that you're doing as part of our expert panel. We are really looking forward to working with you this year as we aggressively address this extremely important issue of equity and what we can all do together to make it better, and what LeapFrog can do specifically to make sure that this is always a priority for the quality and safety of healthcare in our country. So thank you all again for participating today.
And this
thank you, everyone. Have a wonderful
day. Thank you.
Take care.
This concludes today's call. Thank you all for your participation. You may now disconnect.